Listening Library presents Viral, The Fight Against AIDS in America by Anne Bossom. Read for you by Vikas Adam.
For Barbara Cornell, mother of my friend Michael Riesenberg, 1958 to 1993, and for all the mothers and fathers and grandparents and sisters and brothers and lovers and spouses and daughters and sons and nieces and nephews and uncles and aunts and friends and co-workers and doctors and nurses and caregivers and strangers who lost people they knew to AIDS and who still do.
Prologue. He has slimming disease, Nigerians told the American medical worker in 1964 when they took her to see a sick man from their village in Africa. Local residents escorted Judith Williams to an isolated hut on the edge of their community and introduced her to its lone resident, a man reduced by grave illness to barely more than skin-covered bones. He was a monkey hunter, villagers told her. That is who gets slimming disease. Monkey hunters. Williams asked if there was any hope for the man's recovery. No, they always die, the locals said. What happens is, when they start to get sick, we bring them out here, and then we take care of them until they die. Part 1. Contagion. 1969 to 1983. Too much is being transmitted. We've got all these diseases going unchecked. There are so many opportunities for transmission that if something new gets loose here, we're going to have hell to pay. Dr. Selma Dritz, October 1980. Chapter 1. Before. 1969 to 1979. Before 1969, lesbians, gay men, bisexuals, and the cross-dressing pioneers of the transgender movement lived in a world that sought to delegitimize their very existence. Even the term used to categorize them, homosexual, doubled as an epithet. Every religious faith condemned same-sex attraction as sinful. The medical establishment categorized it as a form of mental illness. And authorities criminalized the most intimate of private sexual acts almost uniformly across the United States, even within one's own home. Just dancing with someone of the same sex could lead to arrest. In most places, the only night when an individual could safely assume a persona from the opposite gender was on Halloween. Such conditions pushed people deep into metaphorical closets and toward tragic self-destructive acts. Oppress people long enough, though, and they may refuse to stay confined. In 1969, those shuttered closet doors burst open during a police raid on a hot June night at the Stonewall Inn, a gay bar in New York City. The raid ignited days of street protests that helped to draw gay people out of isolation and push them toward an affirming sense of community. The Stonewall riots signaled a collective rejection of past condemnations, and they fueled an embrace of the possibilities of gay liberation in the quest for freedom. Freedom from oppression, freedom to embrace one's identity, and freedom to embrace one another. The various strands of what would become the LGBTQ community explored these freedoms in unique ways. Lesbians found strength in a sisterhood of solidarity, whether as couples or as part of the women's liberation fight against the culture's male-dominated power structure. The era's butch lesbians and male transvestites defied the biologically aligned cisgender norms of identity and paved the way for the transgender movement that would follow. Many gay men joined their lesbian, bisexual, and trans allies in an ongoing fight for increased civil and legal rights. A good number of them also pursued trails of personal liberation that often came down to one thing. Sex. Uninhibited, unrestrained sex. All of those loves that dare not speak their names, all of those forbidden sex acts, recalled Roger McFarlane, were free for the taking in places like New York City, as he discovered after moving there from rural Alabama. Baby boomers, that abundant population that came of age during the 1960s and 1970s, looked around and found plenty of people ready to explore territory previously shrouded by taboo. For gay men, what they experienced was not just pleasurable, noted McFarlane. It was also very liberating because it removed shame. It removed shame by the bucketfuls. It replaced shame, in fact, with great joy and self-discovery of your body and other people's, and loving each other, and, I mean, all the good stuff about free love. Free love. The idea that it was okay to enjoy sex with or without emotional bonding, and that someone could love multiple partners simultaneously. Free love. It was heady. It was liberating. And it was fun. It was also big business. An urban infrastructure blossomed after Stonewall that supported, and made money from, men having sex with men. During previous decades, gay communities had taken root in coastal cities such as New York, San Francisco, and Los Angeles at neighborhood networks of underground gay clubs and bars. During the late 1960s and 1970s, as laws became less restrictive, these businesses came out of hiding, and they multiplied, diversified, and thrived. There were bars that catered to particular fetishes and attires. Clubs where dancing prevailed. Places with darkened back rooms. And always, everywhere, the temptation to hook up for sex. Gay men cruised weightlifting gyms. They visited informal meetup spots such as the abandoned piers and warehouses of Lower Manhattan in New York City. Even during an era where gay people generally remained closeted around coworkers and family, the networks existed for finding like-minded friendship and more. One of the most enticing places to mingle was in gay bathhouses. Although these establishments had a veneer of respectability about them, offering swimming pools, exercise equipment, steam rooms, showers, a staff of masseurs, live entertainment, and other amenities, the underlying purpose of a bathhouse was unmistakable. Come to man's country, a New York destination advertised, and develop your body, or a friendship with somebody else's. Visit us once, and you'll come again and again. Someone looking for sex could lounge in a private changing room, door ajar, and wait for a stranger to walk in. It was simple, recalled writer Larry Kramer. It was like going into a candy store. As the 1970s built toward their hedonistic crescendo, disco music took hold, and its irresistible, unrelenting beat pulled bodies into such legendary dance clubs as Studio 54 in the center of New York City, or the gay-oriented Saint in Lower Manhattan. Illegal drug use was on the rise everywhere, from the straight world to the gay party scene, where it became an essential part of the entertainment. Marijuana, cocaine, LSD, Quaaludes, speed, Special K, ketamine, and mescaline were in abundance. So was inhaled amyl nitrite, a tactile-enhancing substance that went by the street name of poppers because of the sound made by breaking open its packaging. More drugs led almost inevitably to more sex, and more sex led to more experimentation. But even in places like New York City and San Francisco, public displays of same-sex affection drew everything from sidelong glances to violent attacks beyond all but the most tolerant settings. People of color who were gay faced double doses of discrimination and risk. Laws overwhelmingly sided with employers who fired gay employees, landlords who evicted gay tenants, and businesses that excluded gay customers, all of which happened with disheartening regularity. In consequence, long before the emergence of the term safe space, gay-dominated retreats sprang up at select locations for those who could afford them, including Fire Island, a 30-mile-long barrier island off the coast of Long Island beyond New York City. The subterranean revelry of nearby Manhattan burst into full bloom under the sunshine and through the endless nights of the island's
Sample complete. Ready to continue?